have several things I want to talk to you about. First and foremost is the problem of epidemic meningitis in Africa. Secondly, development of a new conjugate MenA vaccine, some trial results, that is, of our phase one and phase two clinical trials. And lastly, I want to finish on an optimistic note in terms of what I think might happen with the introduction of this vaccine. On this slide is a slide showing the cases from 1950 to 2006 in Africa, with the ordinate going from zero to 200,000 cases annually. And if you look at this particular curve, it basically bounces all over the place, but at about every 10 years, there's a major spike. And this is a classic presentation for epidemic meningococcal meningitis in sub-Saharan Africa. It causes mini epidemics each year, and then about every 10 or 12 years, there are epidemics that occur. The last major epidemic was in 1996, 1997, when there were about 188,000 reported cases. It was felt that there probably during this epidemic there were about 400,000 cases that occurred. Now, remember that in the United States, the total burden in a population that's about the same through this meningitis belt, and this is this blue area would be the African meningitis belt, about 350 million people here in the United States, I think now about 300 million in the United States, and the U.S. has somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 cases per year. This is what an epidemic looks like. This is the 2007 MenA epidemic in Burkina Faso. There aren't enough hospitals. This is the hospital. The hospital is the open air. This mat is the bed. And this is the mother taking care of this youngster with MenA meningitis. Here's a young boy. See this? This is a jug of water. And this young boy had some seizures just a while before. And this is the mother putting water on this child in an effort to decrease the temperature of this child so the child wouldn't have another seizure. And this is a boy who is going to survive. The only problem is this boy is now deaf. This is a bad news disease. As any of you who have gone through perhaps a few cases, or some of you perhaps have gone through an epidemic of meningococcal meningitis within your communities, you can attest to how this disease is detested by mothers and by, frankly, everybody. This disease has been controlled somewhat in West Africa with the use of polysaccharide meningococcal vaccines that have been used for well over 20 years. These vaccines don't work terribly well in West Africa. They're not active in infants. The immunity is short-lived, as I'll show you a little bit later on, and there's no herd immunity. But despite all of this, these are the only vaccines. This was essentially the only game in town. And African countries currently and have purchased, at least for the last 10 or 15 years, about 20 million doses of conjugate meningococcal vaccines annually. And this is what it looks like when there's an epidemic, and this is an epidemic, I think it was 3 years ago, again in Burkina Faso, where their response is once an epidemic occurs within a community is a series of lumbar punctures, the identification, characterization of the agent, and then making sure that there's enough vaccine that's around. Usually the vaccine has to come from Europe or from Europe. And the vaccine has to arrive, you have to get the immunization teams, et cetera. As you can imagine, under the best of circumstances, that takes time. What you need to understand is the average length of time for a meninge epidemic is about 6 or 7 weeks. So frequently, you get to an epidemic area or a district for immunizations, usually at week 7, week 8, week 9, week 10. And it's no great surprise that a strategy like this is not very effective because it occurs essentially after the exhaustion of susceptibles. Well, this problem has been a problem for a long time, and it has occurred as there's been the evolution towards conjugate vaccines. And this slide just simply compares attributes of polysaccharide vaccines and conjugate vaccines, and I think this information is familiar to many of you. Polysaccharide vaccines, while they work pretty well in adults, really don't work very well in young children, and importantly, do not have an impact on colonization, which is exactly what Keith was talking about in terms of the genesis of herd immunity. Whereas the studies of conjugate vaccines have shown that these conjugate vaccines, that is, when you take polysaccharide and link it to a carrier protein, that new vaccine now is transformed into a far more immunogenic product than is the root polysaccharide vaccine. And importantly, these vaccines have a major effect on colonization. Well, that's sort of background. The meningitis vaccine project was created in 2001, and it was a follow-on to the 1996-1997 epidemic, which was so bad that ministers of health from Africa really pleaded with the World Health Organization, please do something about this. Large vaccine manufacturers had tested vaccines in sub-Saharan Africa, but because of the opportunity costs, these are the poorest countries in the world, there's not very much money to be made within that area. And if you make this vaccine, obviously you can't make other vaccines. And so consequently, there were really no products that were being developed. The grant was given to establish the meningitis vaccine project with specifically the goal of developing conjugate meningococcal vaccines for use to eliminate epidemic meningitis as a public health problem. And this is sort of the story over the last four, I guess now 6.5 or 7 years that the project, or how the project has evolved. The project began with visits to African public health officials in terms of asking African public health officials what must be in place for a product to be translated as a successful product? And they basically said three things. Number one, cost of vaccine is the most important limiting factor. Two, these are the poorest countries in the world. And three, if a new product is to be successful, it has to cost less than 50 cents a dose in order for that vaccine to be harmonized within the financial planning activities of ministries of health and ministries in finance. And we didn't quite realize it at that time, but by the spring of 2002, we had established a ceiling price for a vaccine that we were going to develop. We discussed development, obviously, of the vaccine with major vaccine manufacturers. None was interested. And so in 2002, we decided to become a virtual vaccine company and develop a monovalent MenA conjugate vaccine. We identified a Dutch company that would produce vaccine-grade A polysaccharide. We identified a public laboratory in the United States that was willing to transfer the intellectual property for a method of conjugation, that is, linking polysaccharide to carrier protein, and we identified an Indian company that was willing to provide the carrier protein as well as to make the vaccine. And this is what this looked like as a model. The model involved identifying a source of raw materials, a manufacturer, and the intellectual property of a conjugation method, and MVP worked as the harmonizer. In other words, developing contracts with each one of these and actually putting this together with a goal of having a vaccine at a target price of 40 cents per dose. And this is the vaccine. The Serum Institute of India is the manufacturer of the vaccine. Cinco Biopartners in Amsterdam supplied the MenA vaccine-grade MenA polysaccharide, and the Food and Drug Administration in the United States developed, patented, and transferred to Serum Institute of India a new conjugation method. This vaccine was developed, And we introduced the vaccine, or began phase one studies. The first study was done in India. It was a phase one study that compared the MenA conjugate vaccine versus the MenAC polysaccharide vaccine, which has 50 micrograms of A polysaccharide. The conjugate vaccine has 10 micrograms of polysaccharide A, and with control vaccine, a tetanus toxoid. These were young Indian subjects. There were no serious adverse events, and serologic studies showed that the vaccine was very immunogenic as well as being safe. We then began phase two studies in Mali and in the Gambia. This study was 612 to 23-month-olds, and this study is the pivotal study of the entire project. It's a head-to-head comparison of the conjugate vaccine against a polysaccharide vaccine with HIB vaccine as control, looking at safety, immunogenicity, and memory, or as it's now called, boostability, I guess. The recruitment was finished in November 2006. There were no safety issues with first dose that was received. And on this slide is shown the group A specific IgG GMCs, that is geometric mean concentrations, in the three groups. This is the conjugate vaccine, the polysaccharide vaccine, and the HIB vaccine. This is a log scale, and the response after a single dose in 12 to 23-month-olds was superb, yielding an average of 18 micrograms per ml of IgG antibodies specific to MenA versus 1.5 micrograms per ml with polysaccharide, and of course nothing for the control, the HIB control. And furthermore, when we looked at those individuals 4 weeks after receipt of the vaccine that had antibody titers greater than 2 micrograms per ml, which have been associated in Finnish studies with robust protection, virtually all of the individuals, well, 99.5%, were protected after a single dose of the conjugate vaccine as compared to about 40% with polysaccharide vaccine. These data were very encouraging and were followed by data that have just been released. And when I say just been released, I mean like 3 or 4 days ago. And I have to go through a little bit of the design. There were 600 individuals who were part of the trial. 200 received the MenA conjugate vaccine, 200 the polysaccharide vaccine, and 200 HIB vaccine. 10 months later, these three groups were then subdivided into three more groups, and I'm going to go through only two of these three groups. The initial PSA-TT yielded very high serum bactericidal antibody titers 4 weeks after receipt of the vaccine. Here it's 6,234. 10 months went by, and they were boosted with a second dose of conjugate vaccine. A third of them received what's called a memory challenge with a small one-fifth the dose of the MenA polysaccharide, and a third group received a control, simply HIB vaccine. And as you can see, the serum bactericidal antibody titers at 6,000 fell to about 1,000 in 10 months. And you need to understand that we think the protective titers are probably somewhere in the range of 1 to 8 to 1 to 16. In other words, the bactericidal titers were really quite robust even 10 months after after immunization. And 7 days after receipt of a second dose of conjugate vaccine, the SBA titers went to levels that are really astronomical, 21,000, and then at 28 days leveled out to titers of 1 to, or geometric mean titers of 1 to 10,000. These are indicative of a very immunogenic product. In the same vein, if one looks at receipt of what would have been the control group, that is the group that received 50 micrograms of polysaccharide vaccine, the serum bactericidal titers 4 weeks after receipt are at 365, about 1/20th of what one would expect with a conjugate vaccine. In other words, the conjugate vaccine was about 20 times more immunogenic. If, on the other hand, you now take this group that has received polysaccharide vaccine and give them a single dose of the conjugate vaccine, there is a very impressive immunogenic response that essentially is like the immune response that is seen with adults. The important point here is that in Africa, I would dare say that in the area that we work in, probably a third to two-thirds of all the children will have received at least one dose of polysaccharide vaccine. So if you introduce a new conjugate vaccine, it is introduced in a milieu that has already seen polysaccharide vaccine. And there are individuals who said, well, you have to make sure that there isn't anything bad that's going to happen if they've already received polysaccharide vaccine. Delighted to point out that there were no serious adverse events nor even a scintilla of adverse events in any of these particular groups. I'm going to skip through the next and finish this if I can. Our plans are to introduce the vaccine, we think, next year, in the fourth quarter of next year, and begin by immunizing all 1 to 29-year-olds in Burkina Faso. That's a population of about 14 million. We expect to immunize somewhere in the range of 10.5 million. And after that, the vaccine will be sort of rolled out across the meningitis belt. This is the 2009 target, as I said, Burkina Faso. And this is followed by Mali, Niger, and we probably will add Chad. And in 2011, the rest of Sudan, Ethiopia, and northern Nigeria. What do we think is going to happen after this introduction? We think that there is every piece of evidence would suggest that we will establish very strong herd immunity with broad community protection and the cessation of MenA epidemics. And over 10 years, that gets translated into preventing somewhere in the range of 1.3 million cases of meningococcal meningitis, 130,000 deaths, and 250,000 cases of neurologic disability. Obviously, there are new public health resources that get freed up, and because the vaccine is affordable, there is every indication that this sort of intervention will be sustainable. This is my last slide. And this is a school for the deaf in Burkina Faso that we've gotten very close to over the years. And my hope, and I'm going to do the same thing Walt did, is that my hope is that, and you need to understand that about 80% of these kids are in the school for the deaf because they've recovered from meningococcal meningitis and they're deaf. From that disease, is to see this school get much, much smaller over time. Thank you.
Thank you, great. Thank you very much, Mark. We have maybe about 2 or 3 minutes for questions for Dr. Ornstein, Dr. LaForce. If you have any questions, please come and introduce yourself first.
Hinman with a question for Mark LaForce. You've been studying the vaccine in 12 to 23-month-olds. This is not an age that is common as a part of the primary immunization course in the expanded program on immunization. Is the anticipation that this would be become a part of the routine immunization schedule in these countries? And if so, are you looking at immunization at less than 12 months of age since most conjugate vaccines work pretty well?
To answer the question, the answer is yes. We have an under one study that begins this summer that will be evaluating two dose versus a single dose at 9 months, during the 9 to 12 month window with measles, or a two-dose strategy, 14 weeks and 9 months.
Hi, Peter Szilagyi from Rochester. Two wonderful talks, thank you. A question for Walt. What is going on in India, in the Indian subcontinent, with the lack of the second dose? And are there lessons for the, are there global lessons about that?
There have been issues. I think one of the big issues deals with polio and the difficulties in achieving polio eradication in northern India. And India has been very different on polio with regard to other endemic countries. Vaccine failure appears to be playing a major role, and there have been major efforts with regard to mass campaigns. I think the big concern is, thus far, they haven't perceived it as a priority. I think there are groups that are trying to push that, and they've been fearful about mass campaigns with injectable vaccines, but in essence, they have undertaken mass campaigns against Japanese encephalitis in a number of areas in India and done quite well. But I think it's been an issue of priorities, and I think this kind of information, as it becomes clearer and clearer, will begin to move them forward. I don't anticipate that this will be a forever kind of problem.
Thank you again for a wonderful talk. Could you tell us about what the vaccine ended up costing? And being very sensitive to shortages in the United States, how can you ensure production of the vaccine with this very novel production?
The price for the first, the transfer price for the first 25 million doses has been negotiated in a contract that's signed, sealed, and delivered. That cost is 39.6 cents a dose. Any other cost increases are related to global inflationary, in other words, mathematical formula that come from an independent source. And that, again, is part of what has been negotiated. In other words, there is no likelihood that the vaccine will all of a sudden, because it's popular, the price will be doubled. Now, what about capacity? The capacity was originally established at 25 million doses per year with a target of 250 million doses over 10 years. We've had to ratchet that, and Serum Institute is in an excellent position to move to about 40 to 50 million doses per year in terms of production.
Jay.
I just had a comment on the previous question on India to add, what about Switzerland and what about Japan?
I'm less optimistic there. I think what it is WHO needs to be stimulated all the time with measles in their own backyard. I think that has been a serious problem. I think it's going to require continued efforts. I mean, again, I hearken back to our own country and the efforts I remember for years we could guarantee each EIS officer who came to immunization the ability to investigate a measles outbreak because they were extremely predictable. I think it's going to require that kind of leadership to push. I am concerned about some of the safety issues and the back to nature kinds of efforts. But I think you need to keep doing what you're doing in terms of publicizing this kind of information. And I think trying to push local authorities, what's interesting is Switzerland, in addition to WHO, has some of the major leaders in vaccinology in the world, trying to work with them in terms of documenting the health impact of some of these problems. Japan, I think, is moving forward. I was at a meeting in Tokyo in December, and I think there are more people there taking it seriously. But again, I think we don't deal with data very well. We deal with anecdotes. And I think what's needed is to collect the right anecdotes and to use those anecdotes. I am looking at Alan Hinman here. Anecdata always will trump data, but we need to find anecdotes that illustrate data and begin using that as a communication tool.
Okay, maybe a couple more questions since there's no other session after that and there's interest. So.
I'd like to congratulate both of you first. The world for bringing measles, which is, to my knowledge, the most infectious disease I have ever met, and for bringing the good news, and to Mark for the excellent initiative using very creative strategies to get the vaccine that has the right price for the third world. In regard to the use of injectable vaccines in campaign strategies, I have lived through campaigns in Haiti, Angola, and places like that, which are probably the worst you can get. And you can really deliver over 90% coverage in a place like Haiti, not once, not twice, even more than that, if you work well. So I think there is a taboo about injectable vaccines. It's difficult. It's not impossible. Measles is a very good vaccine. And I congratulate you, Mark, for your vaccine. Thanks.
Thanks, Hector. And I think, again, in Africa, I think motivation has been there. And it's been there from the beginning. I remember even before I came to CDC, I was told some of the early CDC efforts in smallpox in the 1960s, the real interest was measles. So I think it was smallpox, in a sense, was the add-on. And I think the problem has been getting the will. But I think certainly it can be done. And as I said, even in India, the Japanese encephalitis experience shows, in fact, that they can do those kinds of campaigns.
Hi, Greg Armstrong from CDC. Just a question for Dr. LaForce. The vaccine is a serogroup A vaccine, but there are other serogroups like W135 and X that have caused outbreaks in the last several years in sub-Saharan Africa. How much of an issue is that, and is there any data at all to say whether there might be any replacement once we start immunizing against A?
Important question. About 85% of all meningococcal bacterial isolates from sub-Saharan Africa are MenA. If you define epidemics as having incidence rates of 100 per 100,000, and that's a pretty fair definition that most epidemiologists have used in sub-Saharan Africa, just about every single epidemic at rates like that are due to MenA. W135, C, X occasionally get to rates of about 25, except for one exception, and that was in 2002, where W135 may have gotten as high as 90 per 100,000. And so the main thrust has really been the removal of this disease burden that is MenA. Now, what's going to happen? Well, that's why you have surveillance. Not knowing what's going to happen isn't a reason not to do something. It's a reason to be prepared to study that. Because we would say the next facet of this is really to look at an affordable polyvalent conjugate meninge vaccine for Africa that's a WCA conjugate at maybe $1, $1.50 a dose. And that's the vision that a lot of us have in terms of looking at what the picture should be like over the next 10 years. Finish MenA, put in place the development of a polyvalent vaccine that's likely, and perhaps one with X, and then go through the same sort of process, all maintaining, during this time, a surveillance system that's going to allow you to describe what has happened and put oneself in a position to be able to see what will happen. I'll just finish with one observation. In 2001, all of Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, all of the predictions in terms of serotypes was based on 34 isolates. 34 isolates are what gave you all these big graphs with these countries with an A or a C on it. Well, that's ludicrous. With the investments that have been made through WHO, with the help of CDC, with the help of USAID, we're now up to, 3,000? isolates per year. And I think with 3,000 isolates that are properly characterized, we now have a real feel for what's going on that we actually didn't have in 2001. Thank you.
And actually, Mark, with the, you didn't have the time to go over all the preparations, but as a side benefit for the project, it's the significant ramp up of surveillance activities in the region to be able to do to the implementation and monitor the impact of vaccines. So, okay, all right, Alan, you get the last question.
Okay, well, this morning, Oren Levine told us about, with the HIB ADIP, about how vaccine, excuse me, with the pneumo ADIP, how vaccines are being subsidized by Gavi Fund, with a ceiling being placed on how much developing countries will have to pay for them. We have in existence a quadrivalent meningococcal conjugate vaccine. Is there any prospect that a similar kind of arrangement might be made for that vaccine?
Good question. I don't know. Again, the vaccine would have to be made in sufficient quantity, and right now that's a problem, at least in just simply meeting the needs in the United States and I think in Europe. So what would have to happen, and also, again, we say that if you have a vaccine price that is supported, the assumption is this is going to be supported in perpetuity. The project that we described basically started with what's the price that's affordable to African countries without Gavi. And that is as sure a statement of sustainability that one can have. And so I usually like to answer the question in terms of saying that the route that the meningitis vaccine project chose to pursue is what's called the push mechanism. How do you invest to lower risk for developing country vaccine manufacturers to produce, you know, excellent vaccines but at affordable prices? And that's a lot different than what was described earlier today, which is basically make it and we'll buy it. So it's really quite different, Alan. Thank you.